So, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Tis the season to be jolly. We hear carols blasting from speakers in stores and restaurants and public spaces. Tidings of comfort and joy. Joy to the world. We can't help but be exposed to these messages whether or not we celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ. But for many people, this is not a time of year that's particularly joyous. Have you ever noticed that? How stressed people get? It is a time when the ache of loneliness sometimes feels deeper, the pain of family conflict or estrangement sharper. The short, dark days of winter can make depression bleaker. Or maybe the death of a loved one or the diagnosis of a life-threatening illness can make joy seem a distant memory. After the end of a relationship, memories of former happiness can seem bittersweet. Or perhaps the frantic busyness of the holidays doesn't allow much room for real joy. And then there's the news. Plenty of evidence that human greed, hatred, and ignorance continue to cause endless suffering in our world. Not much joy makes it to the headlines, but they try a little harder to put some in at this time of year in the news. So I find myself, it's become something of a tradition, I find myself wanting to do a talk about joy each year at this time. And in past years, I've talked about specific different kinds of joy in Buddhist practice and specific practices that we can do to cultivate them. But I'm going to take a little bit of a different tack this year, as you will see. Suffering, the Pali, the ancient Pali word for suffering is dukkha, as most of you know, is the bitterness of life. And the first noble truth the Buddha taught was that life entails dukkha. But the Buddha never taught that life is nothing but dukkha, even though that's sometimes how it's presented, and I have heard that. You know, life is dukkha, period. But that's not really what the Buddha taught. There's another word, sukha, which means the sweetness of life, joy. And just like sweet foods, sweet nutrition, we have to be able to take in the nourishment of sukha, fully savor it in the moment, without craving it, becoming addicted to it, or feeling sorry for ourselves when we don't have it. We can even learn to discover the sweetness in things that we thought were bitter, like Brussels sprouts. Or certain people. The trick is to steam them lightly. A little horseradish sauce doesn't hurt. But can we even discover the sweetness in the most painful parts of our lives? Sickness, old age, death, all the other kinds of suffering? It seems like a lot of people I know lately, or have heard about, are dealing with their own or a loved one's cancer diagnosis and treatment, or even age, end stage, or aftermath. Cancer seems to be the plague of our so-called developed world. And our treatments, although they're becoming somewhat more refined, still mostly follow the crude slash burn and poison model, which means that sometimes the suffering caused by the treatments is more prominent than the symptoms of the disease itself. That's what a couple of people have said to me lately. I don't even really feel the the cancer itself. But what they're struggling with is the treatment, right? Which is kind of surreal. And yet in the midst of the pain and uncertainty of cancer treatment, we often see such resilience, such joy. This past week I received a holiday email from a friend who's going through chemotherapy, whose white blood count was so low that she had to postpone her next treatment. So she went off skiing with her husband and her two grown children. She's a real outdoorsy, fit person. And there was a photo of their smiling faces on the ski slope. And you'd never have guessed that her toque covered a bald chemo head. My closest personal encounter with cancer thus far has been with my younger sister's illness and death when she was 35. Long ago, it seems now, 1990. For those of you who don't know this story, she moved to Japan a year after Michael and I came back from our years there. She met a Japanese friend of ours when she was visiting us for several months. They fell in love. She went back, married him, and a year later she came down with the most aggressive kind of lymphoma there is. She underwent aggressive treatment, which eventually failed, and I spent 5 of the 7 months that took with her in Japan. My parents came too for a few weeks when she was first diagnosed and nearly died before treatment could begin. When she pulled through the first treatment, we began to celebrate. First, my mom's birthday. Then Halloween, we magic markered funny mouths and nose on our hospital masks. And then my sister's birthday. We decorated her hospital room with beautiful mobiles and cards that friends had sent. The nurses were in awe. You don't do that in Japan. I thought this was the most amazing room. And they were amazed at the stack of, you know, sort of books about cancer on the shelf, which I had brought along because that's what I do, you know, get books. That's how I cope. So I had the little stack of cancer self-help books, and the nurses were in awe of that because you don't talk about it there. You didn't then. By Christmas, she had a clean CAT scan and was allowed home. Home meant her two-room Japanese apartment with her husband. Not all the way home to the States. Michael came over and spent Christmas with us, and then he and I came back here. 2 weeks later, the tumors were back with a vengeance. So this time when I went, instead of cancer self-help books, I composed a little book. Does anybody remember the Georgia Strait comic by Linda Barry called Ernie Pook's Comics? So I clipped out a whole stack of Ernie Pook's comics and made a little book out of them. And we read them aloud to each other. And we laughed and cried about our childhood, because that's what Ernie Pook's comics were about growing up in the 50s and 60s. And I'd find her tempting treats to supplement the horrible hospital food. And even when she was in the isolation room in the bone marrow transplant unit during the last weeks of her life, we'd watch the sumo tournament on TV with me on the intercom with a window between us, rooting for our favorite Chiyo no Fuji, which means thousand-year wisteria. Sumo names are very poetic. Great big guys with these, you know, Rosie Dawn and poetic names. And my sister said, it's amazing what you can get used to. You know, as her skin was peeling off her fingers. Human beings are nothing if not adaptable. You know, children make up games in refugee camps right now. And barbers and hairdressers set up shops because even when you're in a refugee camp, you want to look good, right? And we make drawings and compose songs and poems even in prison or internment camps. We give and receive joy right in the midst of great suffering. So, of course, there's an old Zen story about this. It's a koan. And it's about Dongshan, the 19th century Chinese Zen master who founded the Caodong school of Zen, which became the Soto school in Japan, and which is the style of practice we are based in here. This koan appears in the Book of Serenity, which is a collection compiled in the 12th century by Hongzhi, and then with later, about 100 years later, commentary added by Wansong. Now, please don't worry about all these Chinese Zen masters' names that I'm going to be using, but listen to what they say. See how it resonates for you. In his introduction to this story, Wansong asks, when the physical elements are out of tune, and I think earth, water, fire, and air would have been in those days, how does one attend and nurture? He's asking, how do we take care of ourselves when we're sick or hurt or suffering in some way? So here's the story. One day, Dongshan was ill, and a monk came and asked him, you are ill, teacher, but is there one who does not get ill? Dongshan said, yes, there is. The monk said, does the one who does not get ill take care of you? And Dongshan said, no, I have the opportunity to look after him. The monk said, how is that when you look after him? And Dongshan said, I don't see that he has any illness. So this dialogue can be taken at more than one level. It could be seen as referring to interpersonal caring. The monk could be asking if there's anyone in the monastery who's not ill. Maybe there's a really bad cold going around. Anyone who can help Dongshan. However, Dongshan says he's still able to care for others. He's not just stubbornly refusing to admit that he's ill and not accepting help. I think there's another level here. But continuing to look at it on the interpersonal level, the monk asks, what's it like to look after another? And Dongshan says, when he does, he doesn't see that person as an ill person. In my work life, I used to train hospice volunteers. And often I would hear hospice volunteers say, once they'd been doing it for a while, something like this. People ask me how I can do such difficult work, but really I feel I receive so much more than I give. I would hear that over and over, and I felt it myself. In training hospice volunteers, we emphasize cultivating an open and compassionate presence, a capacity to see the individual who's sick as a whole person, not just a person dying of cancer or something else. And this being seen as a whole person is something the sick person responds to. We respond to that anytime. More often than not, with trust and openness. The volunteer, or anyone who steps into a role of serving or helping others, often has their own doubts and fears about whether they're adequate to the work of service that they're undertaking. Have you ever felt that? I do, putting on this robe. The robe helps me take that place. And in being received as the person who is, the helper, in having your offering received, Sometimes even in our initial clumsiness, right? When we're first learning how to offer our service. In having that received, we ourselves are healed. We're taken care of by the one who is sick or receiving the help. This is the practice of seeing each person as Buddha. This is Bodhisattva practice. This is, as we chant in our formal meal chant, we chant, may we realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. And emptiness here doesn't mean nothingness or meaninglessness. It means non-separation. There's no separation between giver, receiver, and gift. You're no longer quite sure if you're the giver or the receiver. The gift flows in between. So within each of us is one who is sick, wounded, lonely, suffering, and one who is not sick, not suffering, not cut off from others. When the monk asked Dongshan, is there one who is not sick, he's saying, are you more than a sick old man? And Dongshan says emphatically, yes. And not only that, it was with my whole being that I can look after my weak, ill body right now. How does he do that? When he says, I don't see that there's an illness, I don't think he's in denial. Simply that he does not identify with the illness, or waste energy lamenting his fate, or being frustrated that he can't do all the things that he used to do when he was young and healthy. He just attends and nurtures and responds to what the body, mind, and heart need. In the commentary on this koan by Wansong, he says, this is where everyday practice empowers you when you are dying. And then he tells two stories of how two old Zen masters met their own death. The first one is our friend Dongshan, who we just heard about. When Dongshan realized he was nearing death, he asked one of his monks, when I leave this leaking husk, where will you go to meet me? And the monk kind of panicked and didn't know what to say. You know, that's what happens in these encounters. So Dongshan composed a verse. That's what they do. Though students are many, not one is awakened. The mistake lies in pursuing the path of others' tongues. If you want to be able to let go of the body and leave no trace, practice diligently to walk in emptiness. So he's saying, don't cling, not to your body, to your teacher, to the teachings themselves. True reality is vast beyond words. So after reciting this verse, Dongshan shaved his head, sat in zazen, rang the bell, said farewell to the assembly, and appeared to die right there. The monks wailed with grief. Dongshan opened his eyes, and he asked for a meal for stupidity to be served, prepared. That's what it said. He called it a meal for stupidity. He then extended his life for 7 more days and again bade farewell to the assembly and died as he sat in zazen. This story echoes the story of the Buddha, who actually postponed his death to make sure that the Sangha were ready to accept and go on without him. So the second story concerns Master Fajing, whose attendant was reading the story of Dongshan's death. See, these stories keep curving back on themselves, the previous stories. His attendant was reading the story of Dongshan's death, and he said, that man of old was quite extraordinary. So Fajing said, after I die, you can call to me. If I can return, this will be because of having the power of the way. Seems like there's a little playful one-upmanship going on here. Yeah, I can go on better than Dongshan. Later, when he knew his death was approaching, Fa Jing composed and recited a verse. This is pretty much mandatory for Zen masters. This year, in the first week of the fifth month, the four gross elements will leave their host. Let the white bones be exposed to the wind, and spare finding a plot from a donor. In other words, he's saying, just leave me out in the open. Spare the expense of an expensive funeral plot. Don't go out looking for donors to fund my funeral plot, or my burial plot. He gave his clothing and his few belongings to his attendant to sell and give the proceeds to support the monks. Then, at the sound of the night bell, he sat in Zazen and died. His attendant remembered and said, according to our old pact, you'd have me call you. So he called his teacher three times. And Fa Jing replied, what? The attendant asked, why are you going naked and barefoot? Because you remember, he'd taken off his robes to sell. And Fa Jing said, what did I have when I came into this life? His attendant tried to put a robe on him, but Fa Jing stopped him. Leave that for others later. The attendant protested, what about now? And Fa Jing said, still, it's just thus. I think he's saying gently, this is how it is. I'm dying. Don't try and turn away or busy yourself. Just face this. He's taking care of his attendant, even though he's the one who's dying. So he recites one more verse and then solemnly dies. This is his second verse. 73 years like a lightning flash. About to go. For you, I put a thread through. That means, for you, my attendant, I still care about you. I delay my death for you, keeping the thread of connection to help you let go. And then he says, the iron ox leaps past Korea, smashing into emptiness, shattering it into pieces. The iron ox is a symbol of determined practice. So this verse, that part of the verse, to me seems to say that for this wise old man, his dying was an act of determined letting go. Sometimes it takes determination to let go of this life. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's not so easy. Wansong comments, Dongshan knew the one who wasn't ill, Fa Jing knew the one who doesn't die. Therefore, these two elders came and went freely. When the ancients were about to go, meaning about to die, they frolicked in the realm of old age, sickness, and death. He's saying they were playful and caring even in their last illness, even nearing death. While still living, they're vividly alive, even when ill. And when they die, they face their dying head on. Now you may be starting to wonder, didn't she say this talk was about joy? Why is she going on about dying? Well, I will get to that very soon. Each of these koans has a verse by Hongzhir, who collected the koans in the first place. And this is part of Hongzhir's verse. He says, taking off the smelly skin bag, casting away the mass of red flesh, directly the nose is straight, immediately the skull is dry. So he's describing letting go of our attachment to the body and opening to our boundless true nature. The nose is straight and the skull is dry refer to this opening, this sort of emptiness or boundlessness, letting go. So then there's a commentary on the verse. There's a commentary on the koan, there's a commentary on the verse. In the commentary, Wansong quotes a poem by another ancient Zen master, Sherdo. The poem's called Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. Michael did a Dharma study series earlier this year on this poem. And its closing lines are, if you want to know the undying person in the hut, do not separate from this skin bag here and now. So Wansong quotes those lines, and then he says, Hongzhir says instead to slow off this skin bag. Why is one saying don't separate from this skin bag and one saying to let it go? He says Hongzhir and Dongshan were both descendants of Sherdo. Yet, how could they be so different? How can they be reconciled? Dongshan said, live fully in the aging ill body, attending, offering up your life to others just as it is. And Hongzhir saying, drop off this smelly skin bag. What are we to make of these seeming contradictions? So here's where Wansong goes in his commentary. More Zen dialogues. A monk asked Xiangyan, what is the way? Xiangyan replied, a dragon roaring in a dead tree. The monk said, I don't understand. Xiangyan said, eyeballs in a dry skull. Okay, I'll help you with this. A dragon is a symbol of awakening. Okay, and so are eyeballs. Eyeballs are a symbol of awakening. So a dragon in the dead tree is and the dry skull are symbols of our being kind of scoured out of our self-clinging. That sort of emptiness of attachment, which is of course also boundless connection. So the dragon in the dead tree is this awakening. It's a symbol of freedom. And the eyeballs in the dry skull, likewise. They sound kind of gruesome, but they are actually symbols of awakening and freedom. Obviously, this is not easy for simple monks like us to grasp. So another monk asked yet another Zen master, Shishuang, what is a dragon roaring in a dead tree? And Shishuang answers, still having joy. Still having joy. And the monk asked, what are eyeballs in a dry skull? Still having consciousness. Shishuang's answers suggest that as long as we are still alive in these skin bags, that being free from self-clinging doesn't preclude still having joy, still having consciousness. This is how we live in this material world, lightly, flexibly, with care for suffering beings. Even when we ourselves are ill or suffering, we offer ourselves to the world just as we are. Even on our deathbed, maybe. Yet another monk asked yet another Zen master, this time Caoshan, what is a dragon howling in a dead tree? Caoshan said, the bloodline is not cut off. Human connection is still alive. What are eyeballs in a dry skull? Not entirely dry. So they're playing with this kind of unresolvable puzzle of living in a human body. And as you can see, from the density of Wansong's presentation in his commentary, this great matter of life and death is something that Zen practitioners have been wrestling with, not only Zen practitioners, for centuries, for millennia. This dilemma comes with the human acquisition of self-awareness, awareness of death, also with the awareness of our own suffering and that of others. How do we live with this awareness without succumbing to despair and paralysis? How can we still have joy? We need a skull that's not entirely dry. Because as we are alive, we need to be able to weep the tears of a bodhisattva and care for suffering beings, and weep tears for joy sometimes. When we're fully present, right in the midst of suffering, whether it's yours or mine, doesn't matter quite so much after all. Joy sometimes just arises unbidden, unsought for. I was thinking, well, how would I define this kind of joy? And I was thinking, it's a feeling that arises when we're not separate from our own experience, when we're not cut off from our experience of our bodily existence and the world around us, when we're directly experiencing, not cut off, then joy arises. Might be the touch of a friendly hand, or the sound of a child's laughter, the sweetness of a ripe strawberry, colors of sunset, the beauty of a friend's aging face. The list is limitless. Our culture conditions us to think that happiness is a kind of flashy Disneyland, Hollywood kind of thing. So we tend not to value or even notice small, quiet joys. We have to train ourselves to pay attention, especially when we're sick with illness or heartache. We especially have to pay attention then. There's a quote I love from the novelist Barbara Kingsolver that some of you may have heard me read before, but it bears repeating. She says, "Every one of us is called upon, probably many times, to start a new life. A frightening diagnosis, a marriage, a move, loss of a job, or a limb, or a loved one, a graduation, bringing a new baby home." So notice they're not all what we call bad things, but they're all big changes in our lives. In my own worst seasons, I've had to come back from the colorless world of despair by forcing myself to look hard for a long time at a single glorious thing, a flame of red geranium outside my bedroom window, and then another, my daughter in a yellow dress, and another, the perfect outline of a full dark sphere behind the crescent moon, until I learned to be in love with my life again, like a stroke victim retraining new parts of the brain to grasp lost skills. I have taught myself joy over and over again. Going back to Wansung's commentary, just briefly, once more, he says, there's an old proverb which says, an old doctor seldom uses divination. It means that when a doctor is old, he becomes clear and perceptive. He uses divination rarely. Who knows what kind? I'm sure there were different kinds of divination in those days. So he is skillful. This Dongshan, an old expert, doesn't see that there is any sickness. The young ones trying to come near to look in on him have a hard time because when they try to face him, they are turning away from him. I was talking to one of my friends who's going through cancer treatment right now, and he says that's his experience of a lot of people, a lot of his friends and acquaintances, is that they're trying to check in on him, but at the same time they're turning away. You know, that's what we do when we're uncomfortable with suffering. So he's making a practice of relating to the medical professionals that he encounters in what can feel like a pretty dehumanizing system at times, to meet them as whole people, to use their names and to make eye contact even when they're not doing that with him. And he's had some very interesting shifts and openings in these patient caregiver relationships doing that practice. Wansong says, the cold pine's sick branches are even more outstanding for their sickness. So I kind of feel like my friends are like that too. I think hospice volunteers or anyone who sits attentively with those who are ill or dying or suffering come to understand this and see a certain beauty in human dignity. So can we see others with generous Dharma eyes wide open even when they're ill or hurting? And can we see ourselves that way? When we are sick or suffering, can we attend to body, heart, and mind and still keep our Dharma light burning so that we can offer our lives to others even in our weakness? If we can, we will inevitably experience moments of joy, quiet joy, and perhaps to our own surprise, we'll share them. So whatever this holiday season holds for you, happiness, sorrow, pleasure, pain, I wish you the spacious freedom of letting go. Letting go of craving for our lives to be other than the way they are today. And opening to moments of quiet joy. So, yeah. Thank you for listening. May our intentions